Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Reimagined senior writer Lisa Bowie talks with two members of Step Up for Students' executive team, President Doug Tuthill and Chief Operating Officer Gina Lynch. With the annual 60-day Florida legislative session beginning this week, the three look back on last year's historic session for education choice that saw the passing of HB 7045 and discuss technical improvement opportunities they hope the legislature will tackle this year to improve Florida's education choice programs in order to simplify complexities for families and schools alike. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Today I have with me two leaders at Step Up for Students, Doug Tuthill and Gina Lynch. Doug is president of Step Up and Gina is the organization's chief operating officer and executive vice president for information technology. They're going to share some data about the scholarship program's growth since last year's expansion, as well as some challenges that have arisen since the legislation became law. They also will tell us what changes are being proposed in a recently filed Senate Bill 1348 to update and simplify the application and operations processes. Plus, they'll offer us a look ahead at other improvements that may be on the horizon regarding education choice in Florida. Doug and Gina, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm jealous that Gina has a more impressive title than I do. So I've got to
work. It's just longer. Very long.
Well, so Gina, let's get started by finding out how much the scholarship programs have grown since House Bill 745 went into effect, 7045. Can you give us an overview of the latest numbers?
So we've seen some unprecedented growth this last, I would say, year, but really 6 months since the bill passed, we've really seen some numbers go off the charts. So let me just give a little bit of a rundown. And looking at the programs that we have under management, across the income-based programs, which I'll refer to first, our tax credit program and our FES EO program, our income-based programs, we've had over 300,000 families start an application for students this year. 200,000 of them have been determined eligible, and we currently have 155,000 of those students currently attending a private school. Now, last year alone, we had 133,000 that were in a private school. So that equates to about a 16% increase since last year for these two programs. With our Unique Abilities program, that's the one where we're seeing a lot of growth since the bill passed because the categories of eligibility have expanded. So we have more than almost 30,000 students who are eligible for the program right now, and we've currently funded around 24,000 students. And when I say funded, that means those students received money as part of an educational savings account. The program has grown 37% since last year. That was around 17,000 last year, up to 24,000 this year. So you can see the numbers are just telling an amazing story of growth and actually need for some of these programs.
You know, what I think that does, Lisa and Gina, is it illustrates how great that bill was. I mean, the House and Senate leadership talked about the fact that this was the most significant growth, ed choice growth legislation in the country, and it really has proven to be pretty dramatic. I guess together, Gina, that's like, I don't know, over 30,000 kids, about 35,000 kids who are being served this year beyond what we served last year. And of course, we're still adding kids. I'm amazed at the fact that in the middle of December, we're still getting, 100 applications a day in some instances. So it's pretty amazing what House Bill 745 has unleashed.
Wow. I mean, that much growth has to come with some hurdles. Tell us what some of these challenges are. I understand that the rules require a complicated system of cross checks for students to receive a scholarship. Can you tell us more about that and how it's affecting the process?
Sure, I can definitely explain this process. And it is quite complicated, and even to execute it gets even more complicated. But I'll do my best to really give you a rundown of this cross-check process that we refer to. Well, let's start at the beginning. A parent or a family applies for a scholarship through the Step Up online application. And a member of our team reviews that application for eligibility. So in the case of the unique abilities, we're looking for a qualifying diagnosis. And in the case of educational options, we're looking for household makeup and income levels. We do all that work and we confirm the family's eligibility for the programs. And we report those eligible students over to our partners, the Department of Education. Now, why do we do that? Well, it's because by law, the student cannot be both in a public school and take a scholarship at the same time. The only way to find this out is by having the Department of Education review the public school attendance records for each scholarship student recipient. We do not have access to that information. So this process is done by transmitting files of eligible students from us to the Department of Education. And the Department of Education takes all those students and accesses the 67 public school system databases to see if that student is found in any of them. Now, if the public school reports that the student is in their school, the Department of Education essentially rejects the student's scholarship and does not send scholarship funding for that family, for that student. Now, this information finally gets to us, and we have to inform the family of what has just happened. And as you can imagine, there are times where the student really is not in that public school. And we found that to be the case for over 3,000 students on our Unique Abilities program this year, which you can imagine caused quite an uproar. So we found there was 3,000 found in the cross-check process that were actually not in public school. And the problem caused families to have a delay in funding or not receive funding at all. And we're all the way into December now, and school started in August.
Yeah, I can understand their frustration, as I'm a parent as well. But Doug, I understand there's a solution being proposed for this. Can you tell us about it and how it will benefit our families and our schools?
Well, an overall theme that we're going to talk about today is there's just a lot of complexity in some of these programs. And this is a normal process, you know, as you begin to build out sort of a whole new infrastructure for education choice. Over time, sometimes you have too much bureaucracy, too much complexity, too many handoffs. And what Gina just described, a lot of handoffs there. You know, I mean, DOE trying to ping, work with 67 different school districts. The school districts always oftentimes have to work with all their schools. So that verification process is very complex. And as Gina said, over 3,000 kids on the Unique Abilities basically had false positives. That is, they were identified as being positively enrolled when they weren't. And Gina, I think we also had a lot of means-tested kids also misidentified. I think several thousand of those kids also were identified as being in a district school when they weren't. And obviously, it took several months to get some of this cleaned up. And while families were waiting, and a lot of families had therapies they wanted to spend money on, they couldn't because they didn't have the money available. So basically what we've done in the upcoming legislative session is we've asked the legislature to make this process simpler. So what we've asked is that they eliminate the current cross-check process and hopefully create it with a simpler process. So what we're going to do is, in our proposal, we'll notify the Department of Education when a student has enrolled in our scholarship program. And they will then notify the school districts that this child has now disenrolled from their school district by virtue of enrolling in the scholarship program. So there should be a single statewide database of all the kids in the scholarship program that the DOE and the school districts can ping to make sure that there's no kids enrolled in a district school and in a private school. So we're hoping that that more simple process will allow us to avoid this, you know, several months of limbo for a lot of the kids. So that's our proposal, is to eliminate the current cross-check process and replace it with one that's much more simple, much more elegant, and doesn't wait for children. Children don't have to wait to get verified by the school district. They'll be automatically eligible for funding, and then DOE will notify the school districts, ask the kids that they need to disenroll if, in fact, they're still enrolled.
Well, that seems to make a lot more sense, and I'm sure our schools and our families are going to welcome any changes that will smooth out the approval process for them and get them access to those funds that they really, really need. Gina, what other policies may be causing some issues? I understand each program has complex rules. They have their own separate caps on how many students can participate. Tell us what's involved in managing all of those caps. It sounds like a real juggling act. And also tell us about any wait lists this may have created in some of the programs.
The enrollment caps, or the maximum that we are allowed to put on a program, are challenging. I mean, not only because of the obvious, which is students may miss out on a chance for a scholarship because, you know, demand is far exceeding supply right now, for especially for our unique abilities program, but because there's exclusions to these caps. Now, what do I mean by exclusions? Well, for example, on our unique abilities program, there's a maximum number of 20,000 students that we have been told we can put on that program. However, the law allows for certain situations where students who qualify do not count towards this maximum, this cap. Now, what does all that mean? Well, a student coming from public school, for example, would not count towards that cap, meaning if there were no spots left, all 20,000 were filled, this student would actually still receive a scholarship. And this means that more students can be served over the 20K cap that's in law. However, and that sounds really great because you're getting a lot more kids than the cap allows. However, managing the exemptions to this cap and those who count towards the cap is very challenging. In that we at Step Up for Students, when a parent applies for the scholarship, they're providing data to us. They're telling us my kid was in another, you know, school. They were in a public school. And we have to take that data and then make some assumptions as to how many students may be counting towards the cap and how many students are exempt from it. These assumptions and estimates drive our operational decisions on how many more applicants we can take and how many we can put on the waiting list. However, because we don't have the foolproof information regarding the exclusions, most notably the prior public category, we once again rely on the cross-check process explained earlier to tell us that. This year alone, our unique ability scholarship, we had estimated, based on parent input from the application, that there were roughly 4,000 students that did not qualify for an exclusion to the cap. Therefore, they were all put to the wait list, and that number was reported on December 15th. However, once everything played out and the cross-check process happened, we actually learned after all the vetting was done that there was actually 1,500 more students that are on the wait list than we had thought. Now, this, you know, visibility or lack of visibility is very difficult for us to manage and to make sure we give good customer service to our families, because they're calling to find out if they're ever going to get off the wait list. And if we don't have the visibility into that, then we're not able to give out really good answers. So this has been causing operational issues, customer service issues, and reporting accuracy issues.
And we all know that time is crucial when it comes to a child's education. So Doug, what are the improvement opportunities here?
Well, this is another example where way too much complexity is undermining the quality of the program, the quality of customer service. And so we basically propose to eliminate the caps. The caps are kind of interesting. They kind of go back to the days before the kids were funded through the FEFP. The FEFP is the formula that the state uses to fund kids in school districts. And our two FES programs, the Family Empowerment Scholarship Program for kids with unique abilities and the FES program for kids who are means-tested, income-based scholarships, those kids are all now funded through the state FEFP, just like every other school district child or charter school child. There's no other children in the state who are through the FEFP that are capped. And so what we suggested is that's a relic back from the days before the kids were funded through the FEFP, when they were funded all through tax credit programs, and that allowed the staff in the legislature to better predict what our enrollment will be. We now have much better data. We now can include those kids in the estimate, I think, do a much better job of estimating what the enrollments are going to be. And so our basic proposal is, let's treat these children like every other child in the state who's funded through the FEFP. That would allow us to eliminate the caps. It also allows us to do some other really cool things, which is the way the kids in the school districts are funded is the state gives the school district two payments a month beginning in July. and all the way through the year. So it's 24 payments, two payments a month. That money coming in early, if that were to happen to us, we would get that same kind of funding mechanism that would allow us to give money to schools and families earlier than the school year. Our current process doesn't allow them. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but it does allow us to fund the schools until late September, early October. So eliminating the cap will also allow us to get funding to fund kids earlier. It also, by the way, will eliminate the wait list that Gina just mentioned. Imagine having a child with spina bifida or Down syndrome or autism. You're fighting to find the very best placement for your child. You qualify for a scholarship, but because of an arbitrary cap, your child is left behind. And that just seems unconscionable. You know, we should be committed as a state to equal opportunity, to making sure that every family has an equal opportunity to meet their child's needs. And these caps really undermine equal opportunity, particularly when you have these kind of huge wait lists that we're seeing. And so eliminating the cap will create a lot of simplicity, will allow us to get better funding predictability, and will allow us to eliminate the wait list and all the customer service issues that Gina mentioned. So that's our second proposal. First, eliminate the current cross-check process and replace it with a much simpler process. Second, eliminate the caps and replace it with the process that we use with every other kid who's publicly funded in the state, and treat all these children the same.
Yeah, that's equality is important in education, especially. Well, Gina, I also understand I've heard some things about another process that requires schools to submit to attendance verification reports to get paid. How has this process been affecting them?
Right. So, Lisa, I'm sure your head's spinning a little with the two processes I just described, and now I have a third one to give you. So, yes, the verification report, or essentially in layman's terms, it's taking attendance. So with our income-based programs, that for kids who are attending school and we're paying the tuition and fees, by law, we are obligated to, quote unquote, take attendance. So we ask the schools four times per year, sometimes more, to come onto our system, tell us who is in their school from the scholarship program, and how many days have they been in that school. And so, again, that's the equivalent of taking attendance, because not all families who are eligible for a scholarship actually use it. So we need to know how many have used it and what school that they're in. So we work with around 2,000 schools, and they need to do this process 4 to 5 times a year on our platform. And once the school finishes that attendance verification report, they certify it, and we essentially use that attendance record to pay the tuition and fees to the family and to the school ultimately. Well, because of the mandated cross-check process that we keep talking about, there's a giant, large timing issue for the schools. And what I mean by this is that the cross-check has to occur first before any dollars are paid. So that process takes time, as you learned, and makes it so that payments are received rather late in the quarter for the school. And Doug touched on it too. So, for example, school starts in August, and in most cases, between the cross-checking and then the verification report process, sometimes the first scholarship payment isn't received until September, late September, even early October, or even later. So this whole process kind of feeds into each other and causes a lot of delays for payments to schools.
Yeah, I understand that attendance is important. You do want to verify that if you're using state money, because you want to use it properly and efficiently and be able to be accountable to the public. So I get that. But there seem to be a lot of rules with a lot of complexities. And so, Doug, what else is being done to smooth out this process?
Well, again, we're trying to figure out how to make this process as simple as possible. And so what we want to do is eliminate having to do it this four times a year in the way we have to do it now, and give schools way more flexibility in terms of how they verify attendance. Actually, ours is the only statewide publicly funded program in the state that actually pays based on daily attendance. So school districts actually don't get paid by daily attendance. Charter schools don't get paid by daily attendance. Only in our program do we actually pay based on the number of days that a child's been in a school? In the district schools and charter schools, they do an estimate. But we actually require schools to tell us how many days every child has been in school, and then we pay based on the number of days that the children are in. So that process will continue. We'll still ask schools to verify which children are attending their schools and how many days. But instead of requiring them to only do it four times a year, we're going to allow them to invoice us and let them do that at various times in the year based on their fiscal needs. So, for example, a school might say, look, we need money not just in late September, but we need money in late August or mid-August. And so we're going to look at the kids who have been attending our school for the first 3 weeks of the school year, and we're going to invoice StepUp and let StepUp pay us a payment for the first couple of weeks so that we can get some money in the door, because we've got to pay teachers. We're a small school. We have cash flow challenges. So basically what we're asking is to eliminate the quarterly VR process, verification report process, allow schools to invoice us on a continuous basis, and allow us to pay them on a continuous basis. Again, all these sort of things fit together. By eliminating the cross-check the way it currently works, it gives us more flexibility to pay schools sooner. By eliminating the caps, it lets the state pay us beginning in July. So we'll have that money earlier in the school year. Schools can invoice us earlier in the school year. We can pay them earlier in the school year because we don't have to wait for a long protracted cross-check process. So all this together is designed to simplify, to give us more flexibility, to give us funding earlier so that we can get money into the hands of families and schools earlier, and so that we can improve the customer service for our families. So it doesn't sound, we're not going to have a big issue, big agenda this year. These are kind of technical in the weeds things, but for families and schools are huge. You can imagine a family, like I mentioned before, who has a child with spina bifida, and they got to pay out of pocket for occupational therapy and physical therapy. But because of these complex cross-check issues, because of the various caps, they A, may not get a scholarship, or B, may not get funding until November or December. And so we want to eliminate a lot of this bureaucracy. We want things to run smoother. We want things to be more simple, more elegant. And these are the proposals that we have for the 2022 legislative session that's about to begin.
And how expected are these types of issues when you have such a large overhaul of programs like House Bill 7045?
Well, Bill 7045 didn't cause these issues. What's happened is, and this is normal, as programs grow, as they get bigger, as more students come on, you start to look for ways to create greater efficiencies. And so, when our program was 10,000 kids, these issues were easy to manage. When you're now serving 200,000 on your way to 300,000 and 400,000, you got to start putting in new processes, new infrastructure that allows you to do things more simply, more elegant, more effectively, more efficiently. So this is just a normal part of growth. This is all about process improvement. We're an organization in a state that believes in continuous process improvement. So this is normal. Any organization that is trying to get better every day is constantly looking for how to improve processes, how to improve customer service. What's unique about our business is that we have to go back to the legislature to make these process improvements. If we were in the private sector, as the president CEO, I could do them on my own. But in our particular case, because basically the legislature is our board of directors and they control a lot of these processes, we have to go through the legislative process. But we're really lucky because we have a fantastically supportive House and Senate leadership. We have a strong governor and commissioner of education that are very supportive of these families and meeting their needs. So I'm confident that when we sit down with everybody in the legislature and look at these issues, that we'll come together and find some solutions so that we can provide better services to our families and our schools.
Well, speaking of growth, I know there's some more growth on the horizon next year. McKay Scholarship will become an education savings account. Why isn't Step Up for Students recommending that all scholarships become ESAs in the fall?
Well, last year, as you recall, the Florida Senate actually passed a bill, Senate Bill 48, which in fact did turn everything into ESAs, which would have meant we'd have had 200,000 kids on ESAs this year. The House looked at that and said, that's pretty aggressive. Let's take our time and sort of move in a more deliberate fashion. That's probably not a bad decision because it's given us a little more time to work on some of these processes. We're spending millions of dollars to build a new ESA platform that's going to allow us to provide better customer service for our families and our providers. And so I think what's going to happen is probably in the 2023 legislative session, everything will move to ESAs. We're very comfortable with that timeline. Like I said, it's given us a little more time to invest in infrastructure as we begin to scale up with this kind of growth. Most people don't appreciate that your average family with an education savings account, that allows them to spend money on things beyond just tuition and fees. So when the McKay kids come on board, for example, next fall, that's going to be about 30,000 kids. Our research shows over time that families spend somewhere between 8 and 10 different expenditures out of their ESA funds. So if you have, let's say, 300,000 kids on scholarship times 10 expenditures, that's 3 million expenditures. We have to review every expenditure to make sure they're appropriate and legal. And so that's a lot of oversight and building the infrastructure, getting the staffing in place, getting the technology in place is a big endeavor. So we're fine with this timing, and we're excited by the fact that I think by the 2023-24 school year, we'll have all the infrastructure in place to handle 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 ESAs in Florida.
Well, that is great. Well, I think we've had a wonderful discussion today. You've clarified a lot. I think it'll help our policymakers and our families make sense of all of this. Thank you both for being on our program as we eagerly await what the 2022 legislative session brings.